Hi, welcome to valuationpodcast.com, a podcast and video series about all things related to business and valuation. My name is Melissa Gregg, and I provide online valuation services for mediation and litigation based in St. Louis, Missouri. Today, we're actually going to discuss a buyer's perspective and risk factors in business valuations with Al Danto. He has over 30 years of experience with startup companies, entrepreneurial companies, as well as expertise in the acquisition, valuation, and divestiture of business interests. He has served as a representative for a multitude of engagements. He has experience working with lenders, private equity groups, and individual purchasers or buyers. And he served on a variety of boards, including the alumni board of the Graduate School of Business at Rice University. He is also a full-time professor at Rice University. And he's a member of the NACVA, which I am also a member of. So welcome, Al. How are you?
Great. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yes. So I want you to first kind of tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in this profession.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that introduction as well. It really spans now, it's almost 40 years, 37 years. So I was fortunate enough, I started my own business in an apartment when I was 23, and we distributed envelopes and printing and business forms. I had the good fortune, a friend of mine's company closed down. He had clients, and we just started to broker products that his customers needed. And we were able to actually hire two other sales reps from the company, and we were printing brokers. We brokered envelopes, we brokered business forms, we brokered printing. And we did that. I was working at the NCR Corporation at the time, and we were installing some of the first computers. I'll date myself. It was back in the early 80s. So we were installing computer systems into small, medium-sized companies. And I left that job, and we got a warehouse and stayed a distributor. And then when I was 20, probably I was 27 or 28 years old, we had the opportunity to buy out one of our manufacturing companies. We had it become actually one of their biggest distributors, and there were a couple guys, Guy and Howard Stewart, and they were in their late 60s, maybe early 70s at the time, and they approached us to buy the company. And really, I was scared to death, just absolutely scared to death coming in there. Had no idea what we were going to do. We went to the bank, and the bank said, "I will lend you the money for this acquisition. We trust that you know what you're doing." And they asked me for something called a personal guarantee. I said, "Oh, man, what's a personal guarantee?" That means that we'll give you the money, and if you're going to have to pay it back, or we're going to start taking whatever you have, and you're going to pay that back at one time. So really, my perspective and this perspective of today's, interview, these risk factors, you can look at them on paper when you're doing an evaluation, but with your money on the line and your investor's money on the line and everything, you look at it completely different. That was probably the best. I went on to do about 12 to 15 acquisitions in the printing business, and we ended up having a national footprint. And but that very first acquisition, because of the fear that I had, I probably did the best job. I looked at every possible, I didn't know a thing about valuation. I didn't know a thing about discount rates, but I knew I better uncover every risk that was in this company. Because, I was on the line, right? So we did that and started looking at everything. What happens if the owner leaves? What happens if the customer leaves? What happens if the employees leave? What happens with all this stuff? And we went through, and I know the two owners were probably so sick of me going in there and just asking them all these questions. What about this? What about this? And we went through with it. And that really set the precedent to go forward. And as I learned, I eventually went on and got my MBA, became a valuation, certified valuationist. But really, that heart and soul, that's what you're doing when you look at a business valuation. What's the cash flow? But really, what are these risks? And as we remove and get comfortable with risk, we're really increasing valuation at the end of the day. So that's what we did. So I went on to acquire a number of companies. We expanded through national sales, through catalogs. And then I had the opportunity to sell the company to a private equity group. And along the way, I had the good fortune to be in the entrepreneurs organization and share some keys and successes to buying and selling a company. And Russell Vail, the president of the organization, and I were out one day, actually at a hockey game. And he had sold his company. I said, "What can I do to sell my company and get the maximum value. So you have to get recurring revenue and get yourself out of the business and eliminate all these risks that I was worried about when I bought the company. So we literally went on this mission to try to find recurring revenue in the printing business. So we did magazines and newsletters and contracts and all this stuff. And we ultimately sold the company to a private equity group. We received this incredibly relative high valuation because we had removed a lot of the risk. Mm-hmm. So I was able to sell the company. I went back along the way and got my MBA at Rice. And when I was there, we had a good fortune to be involved in a startup company. And Rice asked me to come back and tell the story about the company. I started teaching classes there. And now I teach full time. I teach all the classes on buying and selling a small business valuation, as well as a lot of our startup companies. Rice was recently named the number one graduate school MBA program in the country. So I'm proud of that. And then I started to consult. People started reaching out to me to help them to, 90% to sell their business and get ready and prepared. And I also got my valuation certificate. So that's what I do. I teach at Rice in the program, and I have a small company. We do some M&A advisory work. It's called Exit Advisors. We'll get into that a little bit later.
Well, and that's why I think, I was excited to talk about this topic of risk and to also kind of get a perspective, because I think what happens with business owners is they just don't know about this process. They don't know what a buyer is going to look at. But we have to go back and kind of remind everybody that valuation, an income approach or a market approach, which is usually the two approaches that you're looking at, but the income approach is like cash flow, which we're always focused on, like what's the EBITDA, what's the adjusted EBITDA.
Right.
But then the other piece of it is what is the risk that that cash flow would continue? And so I think that, during this process, you have written a ton of articles and white papers about the risk component, both real and perceived, in valuation. So can we kind of get started discussing, and we might have to switch to the next slide.
Yeah,
But tell us more about that.
Okay. So absolutely. So you're exactly right. And the job at the end of the day of a valuation professional is really to say, how risky is this potential investment, right? Because we have to say, okay, what level of return do I expect for the risk that I'm taking? So, you can start with something risk-free, treasury bills, and build up to bonds and build up to equities. But then you get into a privately held company and you say, okay, what return should I get for the risk that I'm taking for my capital? So, to all the business owners out there, this is kind of the takeaway, the silver bullet, is that to increase your value, certainly you increase your cash flows as much as you can, but, you have to remove this risk, and that's going to give you a higher relative value. So this is my, I'm a guy that drives a car to the wheels fall off, right? I mean, I just do. We just drive to the wheels. It's always been that way. This is my 2012 Ford Explorer. It's got 212,000 miles on it. I've never had a problem with it. Never. So to me, it's dependable. It's risk-free. It starts every time I turn the key, and it's a dependable. What is this to somebody from the outside looking in? Mm-hmm. It's an old beat up used car. They're going to want the lowest possible price for it because of this risk that they perceive. But I've never had it break. I've never had it break down on me going forward. So it's dependable to me. And that's the way that business owners, you get numb to the risk that's in your business, right? Because you live it and you're there day in and day out and you see it. But someone from the outside looking in is going to see it completely different. So these risks are kind of magnified, and we'll get into it a little bit later when we talk about how do we improve our valuation. But on the next slide, this is an interesting that I share with my class. This is an interesting perception of risk. But if you look at the reality. Bungee cord jumping is about 5 times safer than just getting up and going to work every day. So if I were to say to you, hey, you have the choice of getting up and going to work every day or going and bungee cord jumping, that fear that we're going to put into us to bungee cord jump is going to be a lot greater than just going to work. Mm-hmm. But it's less risky, right? So this is the perception, this fear in perception, just like I had when I bought my first company, or somebody coming in with a group of investors to put several million dollars into a business acquisition. Mm-hmm. They're going to look at these fears, and they're magnified. And there's a great concept on this called risk aversion. And I have an interesting slide on this as well next, but it's this fear that we have. The fear of losing money has more influence on people's investment decisions than their desire to make money. Okay. And these two, Tversky and Kahneman, actually won a Nobel Peace Prize. It seems like, wow, this is rocket science. You know, who doesn't know that? But they won a Nobel Peace Prize, you know, in behavioral finance with this. And I don't think it's anywhere more exemplified than in buying a business, right? This fear that you have and these risks that you have that are increased. So it's a really important concept for business owners to understand, and anyone that's advising them, if you're a valuation professional or something, that these, you know, as we build these valuation models, what is the risk, right, that the buyer is going to see in that? So it's a really important concept to get. It's really the pain of losing is a lot more than got some interns in here. the pain of losing is a lot more than the risk to gain. But as business owners, we typically focus on the upside, right?
Yeah. And I think it's an interesting concept because, you know, it is kind of interesting that we do get more concerned of like, oh, I'm going to spend $100 on this. Oh, I don't know. Yet we don't spend the same amount of time and consternation about like, how am I going to make $100? Right. We get so caught up in the downside that it's not really helpful. But you also, I think you have put together a really good slide about some of the common misperceptions or misconceptions you see with business owners in the marketplace when it comes to business valuation. So maybe we can talk through some of these and it will resonate with some of our business owners.
Yeah, I hope it resonates. These are just common things, and I see them all the time. And it's even sometimes in the private equity community. People that do this a lot will still have these misconceptions. Lots of times people think that the more tangible assets that I have, the higher my valuation is going to be. And that's not really true. These are operating assets that go into generating your cash flow. So sometimes people are surprised to say, on a relative basis, a company with less assets, same amount of cash flow, same amount of revenue, typically be valued higher than a company with all these assets. Because, well, how can that be? Right. Well, it's because those assets are going to break down. So when I bought printing companies all those years, we had to look at the age of the equipment, deduct capital expenses, replacing that equipment out of my cash flows. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have to do that. Many business owners will come and say, well, I've got all the values of my assets and I'm going to add the value of my business. Well, no, that's not true. Right. These are operating assets that are required to produce that cash flow. So it's a very common misconception to hear, right? It's just simply a multiple of historic earnings. Take my historic earnings and multiply them by some multiple, and I'm going to be in the ballpark, right? Well, no, that's not true. Let's say that on December 30th, right, you lost one of your biggest customers, and on January 1st or 2nd, your valuation is completely different. We'll talk a little bit about COVID, but the impact of COVID on different businesses has changed valuations. So you can't just look backwards. It may be an indication of what's going forward, right? But, you know, it's a current and kind of forward-looking earnings that are critical, right? It's not just past. We were advising on about a $10 million transaction, had about $2.5 million in EBITDA. but they had construction and service. And in the year that they had the $2.5 million, they had some really, really big projects. Those projects aren't going to repeat, mm-hmm. right? So we kind of got to take that out and say, okay, what do we expect from these cash flows? The companies in our industry sell for 4 to 5. Well, you're not going to get just because we have to adjust these. So, right. And businesses in the same industry don't sell for the same multiple. We'll talk about that a little bit, but wide range.
And I think if you see like 1 year where the revenues jumped up by $500,000 or $1 million, you have to know that the buyer is going to ask questions about that. Yes. Like they're going to uncover what exactly. happened there.
Yeah. You know, you can't hide this stuff, right? It's like, right. Oh, poof, all of a sudden I had this year and all of a sudden my company went from value to this to value to that, right? You know, you see it, you know, and due diligence is going to uncover those skeletons that come out, right? They're going to uncover it as they come out. So you're not going to fool anybody.
Right.
Not when they're looking at it under this type of discernment, right? And going through that. So, you know, you're exactly right for a lot of the one-time stuff that comes up, revenue and everything. So, another common one that we see, Melissa, is that, you know, again, they just don't sell for the same multiple. And debt, just because you have less debt doesn't mean you're going to get a higher valuation for your company. Mm-hmm. An example of that might be a house. If you own a house and the value is $500,000, if you have $100,000 of a loan left and $400,000 in equity, your house is worth $500,000. You have $400,000 in debt and $100,000 in equity, your house is worth $500,000. Mm-hmm. This is always something, I know you run into it and everyone in our profession runs into it, but future growth. Well, if the buyer does this, and this, they're going to take this company from a $5 million company to an $8 million company. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but they're going to do that and they're going to take that risk and they're going to take that chance and they're going to be the ones that are doing that. So you don't get credit for all that future. It's kind of your projecting.
Right.
Future.
And along right. that same yeah. line, a business might say, well, they're not going to have these expenses. So these expenses should go away yeah. too. You know, I think everybody wants the best of both worlds. The less debt, I think, is interesting because, you know, debt is cheaper than equity. And so exactly. it blows people's minds when I say, you know, sometimes having debt, you can grow faster, you can be worth more. And they're like, wait, we've always been like no debt equals value. And right. so it's a good analogy with the house as well.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, with minority discounts, I think people will say, well, my business is worth, my 10% interest should be worth this. And, you know, a lot of us in the valuation profession, we don't do as much now for stuff like this. We kind of focus on the M&A market. But, you know, what's a 10% interest worth in my business? And it's a minority interest to somebody. So you have lack of control and lack of market. But so people are kind of surprised to see this. So I thought I'd touch on some of those common misconceptions, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I'd like to kind of move into the this concept of averages, right? This is where I see the biggest. So if this is off of Pepperdine has kind of the respected, they do an annual report. I'm more than happy if someone wants to reach out to us and we can send a copy of this, but it kind of shows the averages in small business, by size, by earnings. Very small businesses, sometimes they talk SDE, which is seller's discretionary earnings, all the income that's available to the seller, and they're valued off of that. And as you go up, so as we go up, we see an increase kind of in these average multiples, right? But again, these are averages. And one of the biggest things that I see is we're average, homes that are average, but a business is not, just an average. There's differences. I've got a couple slides that'll show this as an example. So, show this picture. Where would you think that this is? I mean, Melissa, where would you think that this is? Somewhere.
It was probably Missouri a couple of weeks ago.
Missouri, Minnesota, Michigan, right?
Right.
And I could probably show a new slide.
Right.
If we go to the next slide, this was actually Dallas, Texas. It was 15 degrees, 6 inches of snow. I think they probably broke that record a couple of weeks ago. It's 10 right. degrees here in Houston, which is crazy where I'm at. But the average temperature in Dallas for that day is basically 60 degrees. So if you just showed up in Dallas and you said, hey, I'm going to show up for the average day, golf shirt, shorts, right? So average is really, to me, and this may be more, this real world, in business valuation, there's just, all it is a center point, right? a middle ground.
Yeah, and I think that's where everybody starts to say, well, isn't everything like 3 to 5 times EBITDA? Like, isn't every average fall around there? And it's like, well, every business in the world would sell for that. You really have to look at the individual deal, not even the individual company, but the individual deal to understand the value.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think the next slide I'll go into. So this is where I think really captures it. So if I ask you, what's the average between 1 and 99? It's 50, right? So if you say, well, this is what I get more than anything else in the real world from a CPA who advises a business seller, from maybe a valuation person that comes in there that'll run these multiples, right, or run these averages and do this. But I kind of have a math background from undergraduate and through college. But if you look at averages, you have to say, what's the standard deviation? How wide is the norm? Where do we go, right? And if you look at a business, and let's say that the average in the industry was four times. Well, all that means is half was below and half were above. So companies in the exact same industry with the exact same earnings have completely different valuations based on their history and based on their risk. And in my classroom at Rice, I take two flower shops, Linda's Flower Shop, $1 million in revenue, $200,000 in EBITDA, but completely different risk profiles. One's in Austin, no customer concentration, the business is growing, they have a recurring program for birthdays and anniversaries, solid. And the other is in Detroit, Michigan, where I'm from. I'm from Detroit. I moved down to Houston as quickly as I could after college. But but they had Ford Motor Company, customer concentration, they had no internet present, they had bad reviews. Which is a huge driver of valuation now, poor online reviews. Very hard to change those, but these 4.5-5-star reviews can really add to valuation, right? All these components. So, but all we're talking about with average is this middle point, right? Just means that half are left and half are right. So the job of the business valuator is to come in there and say, where along this bell curve should this company fall? And that's based on the company specific risk that you're looking at, right? What are the risks that are embedded in within this company, or maybe the industry, or maybe the area, right, that they're at? But business owners, especially when they start thinking about having an exit, selling, have to really be cognizant of this. So what does it take to move a company above average, right?
Well, and even if you, in this example, if you had two companies that even had similar cash flow and operation, it could be different locations, but if they had like generally the same cash flow, but one has a horrible reputation and one has a good one, I mean, I think everybody in the audience would agree, like they don't have the same value. Like, I don't want the cash flow coming from the trash can. I want the cash flow coming from, the somewhere nicer kind of.
Exactly. Situation. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's hard to break that conception, right? Because, well, the CPA or somebody who made that says, hey, this is what the other company sold for. They say, hey, I've called everyone in my industry and this is what they're selling for, right?
Here's a rule of thumb, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, exactly. So
So part of this, so a lot of the averages, but also I think we're going to get into some of the risks. If we look at, you know, going forward on the slide, talk to us more about, well, this kind of goes towards what you were talking about earlier, is that people are more concerned about losing than gaining. Whereas in the sale process, we're trying to figure out how to get the highest dollar, really. Like, how do we showcase this in the best light so that we get top dollar for it? And so it does take kind of a change in thought process.
Exactly. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, and I've been an entrepreneur all my life, we're optimistic, right? We're incredibly optimistic. The glass is always, you know, more than half full, right? It's three quarters full, no matter what goes on. But again, just to tie this back, what moves, you know, these valuations up and down is when you look at it from the outside and you realize that someone's looking at the pain of loss, and it's asymmetric. They're going to, you know, put more. And so the first thing we have to do is business owners and those advising business owners to increase their values to say, okay, how do I reduce all these? And how do I move myself above average relative to the other companies in my industry, right? If I'm certainly a flower shop's going to have a different maybe average than a software as a service company, than a manufacturing company, but I want to be well above average.
Well, and that kind of gets towards some of your current mission, not only to teach, you know, upcoming valuators and CPAs and bankers and such, but to also help business owners prepare for an exit and increase the value of their company, which when we were talking earlier, I see a lot of very successful business owners that don't always prepare to exit. They just are kind of like, you know, I'm successful, I'm making money, I'm going to work until I die, and this is what I love. And then a buyer comes along and says, hey, would you be interested in maybe selling your company? And they scurry around because they're like, well, maybe, I don't know. What should I do? How should I react? And you kind of get them more prepared. And maybe we can talk about how you do increase the value of your company.
Sure. And again, I think it comes back to people ask the greatest lesson that I ever had in my life. It changed my life, changed my fortunes forever, was when I had that meeting at the hockey game with Russell Vail. And he said, hey, look, take the risk out, get this recurring revenue. Right. And we did that. And so relative to all the other printing companies that are out there at our size, we got this very high valuation. We really did, because we were able to do this. This really came out of, I guess, frustration and empathy. But sometimes I feel like my role, and again, after I sold my company and went back to Rise, people just started reaching out to me, you know, and say, hey, can you share experience? And sometimes I felt like I was a doctor, and a 60-year-old person came up to me and said, man, you got high cholesterol, high blood pressure. He says, what can I do? I said, we should start this 20 years ago. That's a lifetime, right? And others came, you know, can come in there, man, they're in great shape and they run and they exercise and they do all these things. And they were really well prepared and ready. So sometimes it gets a little too late. You know, we'll walk through some of the common risk of a business, but just for example, owner involvement. You know, if you're involved in the business and you're there day in, day out, and the business revolves around you, then what happens when you leave? And again, someone will see this, and that really decreases the value. So preparing and getting ready for stuff like this, maybe a really good example is, a longtime friend of mine, he got free advice from me for years as he was building his business, because we were just friends. I still play hockey here in Houston. I grew up playing in Michigan. I play down here. And he was a hockey friend. And he'd say, hey, I want to do the right thing selling my business. And he intuitively just did all these things. He removed himself from the business. He was a process engineer. So he said, my goal was from the time that a phone call came in or we got something off the internet to the time cash came in the bank, it was a process. And I had nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. And he built this up. He had 230 reviews, Yelp reviews and stuff, Google reviews, you know, 215 of them were five-star, a couple four-stars, and a three-star, which is I really screwed up. But he did all these right things. And then he approached me and said, I want to sell my business. My financial planner said, if I can get this, I have enough put away, I'm ready to move on. And we looked at it, and we did his valuation. And one of my young guys looked and did his valuation and put him kind of about average. Just said, no, we got to put him way up here above average, because you just don't find a little he installed closets. It's a closet company. And it built up a great business over the years. And he just was way out there. So we went out to the market. It was incredibly, incredibly popular. And we put his valuation way out on the curve. And he actually had an all cash offer for $100,000 more, right, than we even put it out there for. And all of his peers and said, well, man, these companies are selling way back here. Yeah, that's because, you know, you've got a funnel and you keep track of your sales and you've got great reviews and you have a process. So all these things that he did got him this incredible valuation when it came time to sell. So that's what goes into it. In essence, he removed the risk.
Yeah.
And people knew it. It was authentic, right? You didn't just make it up at the end, but it was very authentic.
Well, and I think the next slide kind of talks through a lot of the biggest risks that, you know, in typically businesses won't have all of these, but, you know, part of it is kind of looking forward and saying, okay, I was listening to a coach recently and they said, you know, if this sale process fails, right? So let's say we take the business to market and at the end of the year, we failed. We didn't find a buyer. We couldn't get the deal done. Why would we fail? And if you ask the buyer that, they're going to come up with like immediately they would say maybe three things. Well, it's probably going to fail because we don't do A, B, and C. And it's like, okay, well, then before we start, how do we fix A, B, and C so that we don't fail at the end? And it does take some introspection, right? But this is the list, and we can talk through some of these, of the biggest risks that could impact your value that if you have present in your current business situation, that your goal should be over the next 6 months to 5 years, whatever your time frame is, to start to eliminate those, because you will increase the value for yourself today. Not necessarily even at an exit, but like you will have more cash flow if you work on some of these things, right?
Exactly. A really good friend of mine, a lifelong friend, Roger Burks, a partner at Deloitte & Touche here in Houston. And he said, you know, you should really, what you're doing in this is you're really trying to maximize your business. You're making it as best as possible. And if somebody knocks on the door or you do decide one day, then you've done everything right. Right. So part of this is kind of common sense business practice. But you know, a lot of this too, it's kind of like losing weight. It's easy to say to go out there and do it, but it's hard to do. Mm-hmm. Right? It can be really hard to do, especially to an entrepreneur or business owner that's tied up in the day to day and they're fighting all the battles and everything, doing all this stuff, but they're moving their ship right down and to maybe an eventual exit one day. And they have to be concerned with, you know, the shape that that's in. And how they're ultimately going to end up. So, these are the common. I really happy like to get your opinion on some of the others that you see out there. You know, you see it all the time. But you know, these are kind of the biggest ones. These are the biggest risks that we see. You know, number one and two are always up there. But you know, no recurring, you know, predictable revenue. You know, where's your next job coming from? Where's your next revenue coming from? Mm. So like in the case of the closet company, Dave's company, he kept track of where all of his leads came from. So we could say every year we get X amount of inquiries come in. These come in over the internet. These come in Google. These are referrals. These are from contractors. Right? These are from previous owners. This is what comes in, and there are hundreds of them. At the next stage, you know, this is our success on our quotes, on the number of quotes that we get. The next stage this, the next stage that. So despite that, he didn't have recurring revenue, right? Where he customer, but he could get comfortable with how, you know, where that came from. It was quasi-predictable because you just knew the number of leads that were going to come in. You could ramp up your advertising and stuff like that. So But if you're out there bidding a job, and that's how we were in the printing business originally, we had some big customers down here. We had the big energy companies and everything. We'd do huge projects, but that might not repeat. Right. So when we backed off and we started looking for a repetitive business and stuff that we could get, it gave us more consistency, right? So as much as you can do that, that's important. You know, this owner dependency, again, it's a huge risk. If you're the business and, you know, you're in there and you're quoting the jobs and you're handling everything and it all comes through you, what happens when you're gone? Right. So you're like the engine of the business, and you remove the engine. So it's not, you don't really have a company beyond that that's valuable. Mm-hmm. So I'll just come back to David again for the example. He's a perfect example. So we started going through this process. He spent 3 weeks in Italy. Right. And he came back, touched base in the office, and he went back out, and his daughter was a high school senior, junior at the time, and she wanted to go to school in California. They went to every college from San Diego all the way up to the, you know, northern part of California. He was gone. So, you know, people say, how do I show that I'm not involved? You know, can you be away from the office for 2 weeks, 3 weeks? Can it run without you? Because again, you know, we're valuing stuff based on their ability to generate cash flow. And if you're an important component of that cash flow engine and you're removed, then your business has been devalued. Right.
You have to remember that a buyer could ask a very simple question, right? Hey, when's the last time you went on a vacation? Exactly. Do you ever go on vacation? And all you'd have to say as the seller, you'd be like, I can never take a vacation. I've worked every day. I've never, you know, because it is hard. It as a threshold of a business, like you're in phases of it. So there are phases
where phases.
Everybody is reliant upon you. And then you have to slowly kind of create systems that allow you some freedom of movement. We have technology that people can work anywhere now, but are they reliant upon you being available for that call every single day, for that update, for the, you know, all of those things? That's the issue. It's not that, you know, you need to be away. It's that sophisticated buyers are going to ask you questions to get to understand how you work your business. And you're not maybe even going to know why they're asking questions, right?
You're exactly right. And you'd be surprised the number of hours owners that'll say, oh, I've been working so hard. It's just so much. I just want to get in. And you're right. They're asking those questions to see that. And it's, you know, you coined the term, it's the dependency. It's not if you're there or not, but it's dependent, right? If it's, is it owner dependent? Mm-hmm. Makes a really big difference. And, you know, this one we talked about earlier, but a customer concentration. Mm-hmm. So an example of my flower shop in Detroit or Ford Motor, you know, if that person leaves, you know, they're done. And that's a huge risk to get over. So
another couple of good ones is they'll ask you, do you have a CPA? Do you get reviewed financials? Have you ever had compiled financials? And you're like, what? No, yeah. I mean, they do my tax return, or maybe they don't. No, we do it internally. You know, like all those are getting to, okay, are your records going to be reliable? You know, is this really your profit kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And people ask, should I have audited financials, you know, reviews? Yeah. You know, I say yes. I say you're going to get some type of multiple on that at the end of the day because it checks that box. And without it, you're right, it's a credibility. Which kind of leads into some policies and procedures, you know. Again, do you have a process, or is it just something that you know, it's innate? Because someone's going to step in there, right? And they don't have that experience of being in there for 20 years, 25 years, whatever that is.
I like the managers and key employees without non-compete agreements, because I think the non-compete is a very interesting piece of this. I will say that there have been many transactions that we've seen that the key employees have a non-compete agreement or some arrangement, and the main owner typically does not, right? Because it's your business. Yep. You're not going to sign a non-compete with your own business. But that is really good sometimes if after the transaction or in the process of and this is probably too far down the rabbit hole, but I'm going to say it anyway, in the process of allocating the purchase price, if there's some portion that can be ascribed to personal goodwill, there could be a tax benefit. And if you have a non-compete in place with you as the owner of the company, with the company, then the company owns that contract and you no longer have that potentially personal goodwill. And there's always ways around it, but you know, that's far down the deal situation. But it is, it's good. I just bring that up because somebody could read this and say, oh, okay, well, I'm going to get non-competes with all my employees and myself and everybody. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Talking to, you know, before you do huge things, you know, do you have a team of advisors? Do you have an attorney? Do you have a CPA? Do you have a valuator or any of these people that will say, oh, yes, yes, do that, but don't do that? You know, because there's ways that you can go too far off the cliff and it's like, oh, that was a little too much. You went too far there.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's an added bonus that I didn't even have in here. But when you start to talk about these strategies around tax, right, around, you know, the exit and having the proper attorney, right? You know, sometimes you can set up a family limited trust or partnership and move that away. We've worked with some clients who are moving stuff to Roth IRAs because they think taxes, you know, all that strategy is important, and you need to have these professionals that do this day in and day out, mm-hmm. right?
And you have to realize that a lot of times if you're just working, CPAs are great and you're doing your tax returns with them, but it's a mind shift to go from how do I make sure I don't pay taxes, which means I spend a lot of money at the end of the year, which means I make sure that we have no income, and because it's good for tax reasons. And then you go to sell your company and you're like, no, we have lots more income. We make millions of dollars. And there's a disconnect. And people don't understand that, you know, the process of getting financials audited or compiled will also force you to stop putting all those discretionary expenses in there. So it kind of helps a lot of different things, but you have to remember that, like, if you're going to go to market at some point, your tax strategy may not align with your exit strategy, right?
Exactly. And here's something I always say too, is it's, you know, a lot of transactions under $5 million are financed with an SBA loan, right? So all of a sudden you've got all these business owners that have been avoiding taxes. Now, poof, they want to put them on. And I say, okay, you know, it's going to be financed by an SBA loan. It's going to come in here and look at your tax return. I said, do you know what office is right down the hall from the SBA? Well, the IRS. So have you been, you know, you can borderline on that to where it's, and kind of the message that we like to say is, okay, let's say you're going to save, you know, $100,000 by a questionable tax write-off. And, you know, you do risk losing credibility with a buyer because they're going to say, well, this guy's, is he cheating? Taxes are running this through? You know, look, there's nothing wrong with, you know, a trip that you go to a seminar and it's in Aspen or something like that. You write part of it off, but you document, but the crazy stuff. So if you're doing this, and that $100,000 says, I just can't count this to cash. My bank's not going to count it. My investors aren't going to count it. And let's just say your valuation multiple for whatever reason was 5. That's a $500,000 that saving $25,000 or $30,000 in taxes cost you. If you're nowhere near selling the business, that can be fine. But as you start to do it, you got to start to clean this stuff up. So you're right.
No, and it's not like there's a right or wrong way to do this. It's just that you're going to be looking at it from different perspectives.
Exactly.
And, you know, and some of that is just old ways of doing things, you know, like spending down all your money before December 31st in some capacity, buy new computers, buy this, buy that. You know, a lot of business owners are getting to the point where they're like, I want to see really what the financials look like. Like, I don't need that computer or that thing. But I think, again, it's about getting a team of advisors. And once you hit like the $1 million of revenue mark or something like that, you really should start to have a team. how that team is comprised is fine, but just have different perspectives, because one person might look at it from one way that's not going to be beneficial when you sell, and that could hurt you a little bit.
No, exactly. Exactly what happens. And you want to share people's experience, right? You know, like I said, I mean, I bought my first company when I was 28, you know, 30 years ago. And I don't think there's been a day, certainly not a week, where I haven't been involved in some type of transaction one way or the other, startup since then, right? So it's all that experience that you see. You know, a couple others, we'll scoot on through these. You know, if you're you know, some type of forecast, and if you've what really provides comfort and confidence is if you can go back to previous year's forecast and say, hey, here's our forecast on December 2018 for 2019. Here's our forecast. Here's where we're at. Here's what we hit. We're close. Here's 2019 to 2020. You know, 2020 COVID is something different. But if you show that and then you show someone and say, you know, where's the company going? Because, you know, when you hand me the keys, it's mine. Mm-hmm. You got your money and you're gone, but it's mine. So where's this train going, right? Where are we going?
And valuation people, I think, can also help, because I got to be honest, if everybody's listening right now and they're like, I don't create forecasts. I don't do a business plan. You are the majority. The majority of smaller businesses do not create business plans or forecasts. Now, two things. One is that's how business valuation people that, you know, a lot of us do valuations for the same companies every year. Like, we help them do those forecasts. We help them see if they hit those forecasts. But just conceptually think about this. If the majority of people, your competitors, other businesses that are under 5 million in revenue or under a million of EBITDA, right? If the majority of them are not doing business plans and forecasts, guess what? One way that you can stand apart, you do them.
Exactly. And guess where that puts you relative to everybody else on the valuation curve? Mm-hmm. And now you add that into, you know, reviewed or, you know, financially, at least completely down a gap or even on, and that's what pushes you up. You're exactly right by doing those things. And you're right. You can have the help. Your CPA can help you to do that. And you don't have to do it yourself.
It's no,
you don't have to. Your valuation person.
It's harder for people to do it. Like, we have templates, like we walk them through. Cause most of the time, if you say, hey, can you put your forecast in here? Can you, and they're like, what does that mean? You know, but I think the poor online presence,
oh, it's huge.
I think it's huge. I think that it also is an opportunity a lot of times for second and third generation family businesses to improve value by increasing their online presence. But I think that also in this day and age, if you're not doing a million things online, I think you're a little, you know, like reputation is not going to carry you for the rest of this new economy, right?
No, you're exactly right. Right. You cannot change. And that online review, you know, some of my former students acquired a company, had horrible reviews. They got it. It was a turnaround. But they got in there, they couldn't change, even though they bought the company, they can't change the online reviews that are on there just because there's new ownership. I didn't know that, and I'm not sure what it takes to do it or not, but those online reviews are everything. Mm. So, you know, and you look back, certainly your historic performance, I have a slide that I say, but it's say, again, we come back to averages. So if a business had $1 million in sales, $200,000 in earnings, for the last 3 years, say is average. Well, that average could be like this, straight up. That average could be straight down, or that average could be up and down. So if you've got this inconsistency or downward trend, it's going to hurt your average. So, and people are going to look at it. So some of it, you know, you can't change. You have a couple of bad years, but that's why timing in selling a business can be important. It's important to, if you can sell on an upwards trend, you're going to get a higher, higher valuation. You know, one problem we run into, and we can see if your contracts are not assignable, right? So had a very interesting situation. Another colleague of mine down here always had planned to sell his company to a big company here in Houston. But he became the alternative to that company. It was in the recycling space. So great offer, private equity. So we'll you've got to go back now to all your clients and tell them that we're going to acquire the business. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to go through and do deals until we get these contracts. He's like, I can't do that till I get the cash, because that's a part of the reason. Right. And had they been assignable, hey, these are assignable contracts you go through and they have to abide by it. So, you know, it's an important thing. You know, you touched on this one, the discretionary earnings that get thrown in. You know, all of a sudden you've done all the stuff to reduce income, and then poof, all of a sudden you have $1 million. Well, where'd it come from? Mm-hmm. So if you can show that, there's some others that go there. Like I said, I bought outdated machinery and equipment, technology. Sometimes business will think, well, I'm going to hide this, right? So we come in to buy a printing company. This is a 1978 printing press.
Right.
You know, I got to replace it. You know, you're on your computer. You know, it's got to be updated. Those are going to come out of projected cash flows and capital expenditure. So there's a balance to it. You know, you certainly, you have to understand, again, the skeleton, if it's in there, is going to get uncovered. People say, I'm not going to go buy any. Well, it can impact you. Again, it comes back to the strategy. And again, if we're seeing declining revenue, increasing expenses, stuff like that kind of get out of hand, sometimes that'll happen towards the end of the life cycle for an entrepreneur, as they just kind of start taking a little bit more cash out, or they're not paying quite attention to what the perk, you know, they're buying stuff from friends and they've always bought them, but the marketplace has changed. And we see that a lot around insurance. Insurance will creep up. Yeah. So you have this expense creep that can come up. And then, you know, complexity and business operation. You got to understand, someone's coming in there from the outside coming in. If you get this incredible complex, you know, flow chart of stuff that's going through, you want to look at. So, you know, these are some of the biggest ones. And again, if you work with someone that's done this, a valuation professional, someone that's going through, they'll help you to get this. And you really want to get an early start to it. Some of these things you can't change at the very end. They're built in. They're built into the company. So, mm-hmm. And I'm sure you see this a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that we're going through right now is what I've called the pandemic economy at this point. Mm-hmm. We're about a year in to the pandemic economy.
Hard to believe.
I estimate that we have another year, but nobody likes that suggestion. But I think that, you know, part of it is, what can we do? And, you know, how can, if we're dealing with some of these risks, if we're dealing with the risks of the economy, if we're dealing with risks in our own industry, you know, because we haven't talked about those specific risks. Yeah. You know, what is it going to take to get a deal done in this current economy? And what are people looking for that maybe obviously is not falling on this list, but that people should really be focused on?
Yeah. I think we connected on the white paper that I wrote on getting deals done in the economy and how it's impacting valuations and certainly transactions in this space. And I think what's really happened is that, these embedded risks that are in a business. So if you look at the return, and if you go back to the average business in America, and I'm talking about average is again, it's in three to four times multiple range. So 33% return, 25% return. Why some? Well, they're risky. And again, what I think happened, we had a really, really good tailwind going into COVID. I mean, and business owners would say, why would I want to sell my business for four times, three times, four times, whatever the valuation multiple is, pay my taxes on it when I can just keep continuing. Because next year isn't always going to be as good as this year or the previous year and the following years, right? You have these risks. It could be COVID. It could have been your sales reps leaving. It could be a new competitor stepping into town. It could be a new technology that steps in there. It could be a regulation. It could be something like that steps in there. So COVID and the pandemic was another risk. As long as you hold the keys to that business, you know, you're responsible for all those risks. And COVID was a risk. A very interesting thing that happened during COVID, some companies thrive.
Yeah.
And they did really, 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 really well. I'm a part of a farm to market in Texas where we actually have ownership in a processing plant and some cattle. And that thrived. We had to shut down our Facebook page because we couldn't keep up. I mean, we got literally 3-4 months behind that thrived. But is it going to continue?
Right.
I don't know. Right. Other businesses really weren't as impacted by COVID as much, and some were severely impacted by COVID. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the typical MBA answer is questions, well, it depends. Well, yeah, it depends, but it depends on your circumstances that are in there, but you can't ignore this COVID risk. So how we're seeing deals getting done that we're advising on, and we had about 8 deals that we were working on going into COVID, and really we only had one that closed during COVID. The rest kind of got, we got delayed just a bit. And some are getting, one that'll close next week and one that's coming up. But the adjustment that was made was, okay, we're going to make the assumption that we're going to come back to pre-COVID numbers. But how we're going to adjust for that risk, we're either going to do it in valuation, where you're going to take a discount on it, right? Or we're going to give you X amount of cash up front, and we're going to hold back this, and we're going to give time to see if we want to come back to pre-COVID levels. Hmm. And one thing they have to understand from a buyer's perspective, they want the business to do well. Yeah. They want to give you a fair valuation for the most part, and they want it to grow. So we did this, a whole bunch. These were cash deals, and they got comfortable with it. They said, okay, that's fair enough. And it's hard to argue with that and say, okay, well, if we come back to pre-COVID levels, then you're going to get the pre-COVID. But if not, we're going to take it. Or you can wait. Right. And some chose to wait to see.
That one rule that still pertains, which I think is even more relevant at this time, is that you have to show some consistent cash flow. Yes. And so if you had, because I have, the majority of my clients were very successful during COVID, you know, so I think we see a lot of the headlines of a lot of companies that are struggling. And, you know, obviously we're very concerned about those industries, hospitality, restaurant, yeah, and such. And then we have these other, you know, kind of economies that were created based on the, yeah, pandemic, based on COVID-19, and that will continue. But as we move forward into the new phase, it will be consistency. So you had good years. Maybe you had a banner year for 2020, right? Or maybe you didn't. Maybe you had a crappy year. Either way, if we look back from 5 years from now, we are going to remove it as, yes, non-recurring. So if, yep, we remove that out, you really do have to see, like, are we going to get back to 19 levels in 2021? Right. Or is it maybe going to be 2022? Right? Have we started, yeah, the whole thing over, that we need to start to see 2 or 3 decent years, preferably, which way am I going to go? This way, exactly, right? Yeah. Yeah. And if you're not, I mean, that's just kind of general, because I think buyers could ding you if they see some volatility in your cash flow. They're like, then they go, yeah, the average. Yeah. And then if 50, yeah, is average, if you could get $100 for your company, and 50 is average, now are you okay with 50? And they'd be like, well, no. Yeah. I want
to
be
exactly. Then you're gonna have to wait.
Yeah. So you might have to wait. Or right now, I think that there's a lot of money that needs to be put somewhere. And so you have a lot of investors that are looking for alternate ways of investing their money. And there could be opportunities there, but they're not going to just ignore all of those risks that we just went through and say, oh, well, we don't care about your customer concentration. We don't care about your owner dependencies.
Right.
You're going to still be relevant, but it's also going to be like, how did you weather COVID? You know, and
exactly,
in some cases, those economies may not exist after we've gone out of this pandemic. And so then what do you do in that capacity? So I think that there's a lot of things that somebody has to consider even to make that move to exit, right?
Yeah, exactly. And again, it comes back to what you said, and we've kind of said repeatedly, you know, you need to be with people that understand it and they get it and they've got the experience and they can tell you how it's going to impact it. Because that's the dichotomy right now. I was on the phone yesterday, it's totally when we were warming up, with a partner in a private equity group. Here's the thing, here's the interesting thing with private equity and capital. If that sat on the sidelines for last year, their IRR ticks away. it's burning a hole in their pocket. Now they say, I got to go out there and spend this money. So I'm going to go, and they're not going to be oblivious to these risks, but they still want to go out there and get a deal done. So
absolutely. I mean, people are not going to be foolish in this process, but I also see a lot of companies that if you did have a really good trajectory coming into the pandemic and you did excellent in 2020, you may not be able to garner the top dollar that last year could do, but it certainly goes a long way to say that you can weather that storm and that you are going to be okay on the other side. And that's powerful information for a buyer.
Exactly. Yeah. And from the seller's perspective, last year was a tough year to run a business, own a business, have business and deal with that. So that emotional side of running a business, it wasn't as fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can exit and get out and have, you know, you do it at 65 instead of 70, mm-hmm. 63 instead of 70, you know, you're going to put enough money away and you're going to be okay. And so I think we're going to see a little bit more interest. It was, again, it's tough. It's tough when things are going good, like pre-COVID. You know, we had good tailwinds, you know, low cap, low interest rates. Things were going well, but you go through that and it's not as much fun anymore. And you say, well, so we'll see that adjust. So it's going to be interesting.
It's going to be interesting. And I think that, you know, I've also seen a lot of business owners that have been very successful over their entire career. And we kind of got to this 2020 and they're like, I don't want to pivot. I don't want to change. Mm. I don't want to go online. I don't like technology. I don't like any of this stuff. And the reality is, you know, they're going to have to exit or transfer it to the next generation or something, because the risk was so overbearing for 2020 that it kind of pushed them of like, this isn't worth it. This isn't fun anymore, you know? But you also have some issues with just ignoring all those factors, because you might get dinged in price a little bit because you haven't wanted to pivot, or your website is from 1940. No, right. Pre-internet.
There are some from 19, they don't exist. There's companies that don't have them.
But tell us a little, I know this is your passion, and I know we've talked for quite a long time. We've given a lot of good information to business owners, but you know, you're very passionate about Rice University and you are
a professor. I'm even sporting the colors too.
So I think entrepreneurship program.
Yeah. So Rice is a small university in Houston, right? Pretty selective university. And our entrepreneurship program has reached number one. A couple of the organizations out there and always in the top 10. And it's really, goes back generations to the founders of the program who are entrepreneurs and professors and built the program very hands-on. And, that's my passion. A lot of my currency is not in money, but it's in, you know, having an impact and working with the next generation. And, you know, cause I've really been involved, for 20 years now in doing this. And I've seen crazy ideas come through the classroom, and I've seen students go out there and start these crazy, wild ideas and they built them and they're having exits, and now we're coming back and we're trying to get money from them to make donations back to school. So you see all that. It's great. It's a great team. Houston is a very entrepreneurial city. People come from all over. It's a spirit, the energy challenge, but the medical center or the port, everything that we have here, it's very collaborative. It's more of a, how can I help you environment. And that's a spirit that we have over at Rice. So we have a lot of students that come through our acquisition classes, and then they actually get to spend their final two terms to go out there and start the process to acquire companies. We have a lot of success around that. We have a lot of alums that'll put up some capital. We have connections to private equity and those groups that we have. So, that's a passion. And then again, like I shared with you, our exit advisor is really just helping through the process. My partner, Gary Cooper, is a CVA. We actually met it sitting in the back of a continuing education commiserating about this stuff. Do you believe that he's a CPA, came out of Pete Marwick, Big Four, whatever it was back then, and he believes in audits and all that stuff. And I said, well, wouldn't it just be great if these companies could be ready? I mean,
Yeah.
You know you're going to go through and do diligence, right? You know you're going to ask all these questions. You know all the skeleton. Why not just prepare and be ready ahead of time? So, you know, we form forces on that, and that's kind of what we do. But we're boutique, and we work, you know, hand in hand. So,
but I think if people have questions about this process, if they are interested maybe in selling their company, but they don't know, you know, they're a little concerned, or maybe more concerned after our presentation, but they can reach out directly to you. And, you know, and I think it's great that you're kind of helping young people, because I don't think we have enough young people getting into this space. And, you know, it is kind of exciting and interesting, and helps business owners, I think, in a lot of respect. But they can call you, they can email at exitadvisors.com, info@, we have your phone number. So there's a lot of ways they can reach out to you. You have a white paper that you did mention that I thought was really phenomenal. And that's why I reached out to you. But it's about how to sell in a COVID economy. So I think if people are interested, they should definitely reach out to you and get more information.
Yeah. And no problem, Ron. I think the one thing with Zoom, you know, we had somebody reach out to us from 100 miles north of Calgary. I said, how did you, you know, we worked with them at Tottenham, I believe in education first, and knowing about and understanding this. So we have a lot of educational materials on everything, and we'll work with people in other cities if they've got a broker they might want to deal with or something. But if they have anything, just reach out. You know, awesome. We're passionate about it.
So. Well, thank you so much. That was good information, and I'm sure we'll have you on again to talk about something.
There's lots of other things we could talk about as well.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Al, appreciate it.
Thank you.